Hello and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific from PCJ Radio International. I'm Keith Powell. Britain last week became very chummy with China. It's not a new friendship, but it certainly has new heights with the Chinese president given the full royal treatment for his four-day official visit. Xi Jinping even stayed at Buckingham Palace, was given the honor of a state dinner, and had the copious praise heaps upon him. But make no mistake, there is money at stake with this special friendship, and there are plenty of critics. European correspondent Lisa Miller reports from London.
Pomp and pageantry doesn't adequately describe the welcome Xi Jinping received this past week in Britain. Even the Sun decided to join the party. Well, for the first day at least, the clouds and rain soon returned.
Well, I mean, I think Australian audiences are familiar with the sort of tourist aspects of the pageantry of Britain, the changing of the guard and the trooping of the colour and these kind of things. I mean, Britain does pageantry very, very well.
That's Roderick Wai, Associate Fellow at the think tank Chatham House. President Xi was the guest of honour at a banquet. There was a 41-gun salute and a ride with the Queen in a gilded carriage.
And I think the Chinese like that very much because from President Xi's perspective, it shows him being treated with great respect and huge pageantry by an important Western country. That helps his standing both internationally and at home.
There were billions of dollars in commercial deals signed. This visit was worth a lot of money to Britain. But as the Spectator magazine so succinctly put on its front cover, where's the morality? And that's a question a former advisor to Prime Minister David Cameron, Steve Hinton, asked even more bluntly.
Honestly, I think this is one of the worst national humiliations we've seen since we went cap in hand to the IMF in the 1970s. I mean, forget about the terrible things that the Chinese regime is doing at home, the vicious political oppression and the violent physical abuse of women. Just look at what they're doing internationally, militarily threatening their neighbours, empire building in Africa, and on a daily basis, stealing property from businesses and governments all around the world through their relentless cyber attacks. I mean, the truth is that China is a rogue state.
There was a suggestion Prince Charles might have stood up, with some saying the heir to the throne might have skipped the state banquet because he's close to the Dalai Lama. But that was ruled out by others who pointed to the fact Prince Charles spent more time with the Chinese leader than any other royal.
I think if you look at the relationship in the longer term, it goes up and down. It's only 3 years since we were in real trouble with the Chinese over the Prime Minister's meeting with the Dalai Lama. And I expect that we will see highs and lows in this new chummy relationship.
So is there a case then that they've gone to the other extreme because they're trying to make up for that lost time?
There's an element of that, I think. And this is one of the concerns that many people have, that the sort of reaction has gone a little bit too far in accommodating everything that China seems to be wanting. But on the other hand, one really has to put this again in perspective. What we've got is a lot of rhetoric about a very strong relationship, a new golden era, all this sort of new best friend stuff, and a burgeoning economic relationship. But exactly what that means in practice, I think, has yet to be tested.
There are also the sensitivities of that other important ally, the United States. The very special relationship between Britain and China has left some wondering what's happened with the simply special relationship between the US and Britain. The fact that one of the business deals that China has signed involves a nuclear power plant has further raised eyebrows. How this friendship develops will be closely watched.
A while ago, we told you about Eric Tulzak, who arrived at the ABC's Port Moresby Bureau, that's the Australian Broadcasting Corporation, and he rapidly threw himself into the task of covering news and events unfolding in Papua New Guinea. Well, 7 weeks later, he's notched up a lot of kilometres and filed dozens of reports and updates. But perhaps one of the most telling experiences he encountered there happened through the course, well, not of his work, but while he was off duty. Well, he suddenly was confronted with a medical emergency. It was something that gave him a troubling new insight into the country where life is often too cheap and decent health care is simply too expensive for many that can afford it. Afterward, he sat down and wrote down all his jumbled thoughts and feelings And he now brings us this account of that evening in Port Moresby.
Tonight, a man died in the back of my car. Those were the first words I wrote as I sat down and tried to make sense of what happened earlier this week. Even now, a few days later, I'm still shocked and saddened. Let me tell you the story. I did not know the man who lost his life, but he'd been staying with my neighbours. He'd collapsed on his way back from buying rice down the hill. I'm pretty sure he had a heart attack. I was driving out to meet friends in the early evening when I saw a group of people clustered around a man on the side of the road only 100 metres from my house. Apparently it's against every security rule in Port Moresby to stop in those situations, but I forgot that. I got out of the car and asked what happened. A woman told me their friend had collapsed, but he was being looked after and my help wasn't needed. At that point, I could have walked away and kept driving, but I could tell he was not okay. He was being carried across the road and up a steep driveway. There, he was placed on the bare concrete, and people mainly just stood around him, worried but helpless. I decided I couldn't walk away. I said to the woman, "I'm not a doctor, I don't know much, but I have some first aid training. Do you want me to take a look?" "Yes," she finally decided. "Please help." I went over and I asked people to put him in the recovery position properly, and then I checked his pulse and breathing. He was incredibly clammy, taking shuddering breaths, and his heart was fluttering crazily. I shone a torch into his glassy and unresponsive eyes. He was clearly unconscious. I said he needed to go to the hospital, and I offered to help. But the people around him didn't want that. They were worried it would cost money afterwards that they didn't have. No one knew what to do, including me. Then the man stopped breathing. I checked his pulse, and his heart was still beating. Suddenly, I couldn't remember any of the updated first aid procedures from my recent training. I only remembered what I'd learnt 8 years ago. No breathing, begin expired air resuscitation. This is apparently no longer taught. We put him on his back and I showed his friend how to close the nose and breathe into his mouth. I should have begun chest compressions, but I was too busy wondering why his chest was not rising. The friend couldn't get any air in. Everyone looked to me for a decision. Somehow, I had been put in charge, which seemed to me to be terrible news for everyone. Nevertheless, I told them, "We have two options. We call an ambulance and start CPR now," I mimed pressing his chest, "or we take him to the hospital quickly. Which one do you want to do?" No one wanted either. "He's going to die if we don't pick one," I urged them. "Which one do you want?" The man took a gasping, shuddering breath. I hoped he could survive a trip to hospital because I realised that I didn't know the ambulance number. I also remembered reading that they hadn't been running in Port Moresby recently because they hadn't been given funding to pay for fuel. Gerahu, someone finally proposed, naming one of the more dangerous outer suburbs of Port Moresby. "He needs a hospital quickly. Shouldn't we take him to Moresby General?" I asked. "No, we take him to Gerahu," came the reply. "There's a good hospital there." What I realise now is that there's a free hospital there. So I backed my car up and we manhandled the bloke into the back seat. People got in and held him while others piled into the rear cargo area. I took off and I broke several road rules getting to Port Moresby's freeway as quickly as I could. I tried again to convince the people in the car to go to Port Moresby General Hospital, as it was much, much closer. "No," they said, "turn here, go to Gerahu." I argued with them in what local pidgin I knew. "But Gerahu is long way too much," which means long way too much. I was convinced he'd die before we got there. They insisted regardless. I drove with the car's hazard lights flashing, beeping other drivers, and doing lane changes no one should attempt in a Land Cruiser. But we still got boxed in at the red traffic lights on Waigani Drive, one of Port Moresby's main roads. The lights give you a countdown to the next green. This one said 52 seconds were left. I reached back and I felt for the man's heartbeat. I couldn't feel it. "He got him heartbeat?" I asked the man holding his head. He shook his head. "No gut. No." The traffic light said 36 seconds were left before we could move. I sat there with a dead man in the back seat, with a bunch of polite people holding him, all of them looking at me for our next move. As I watched the seconds count down, I wondered what I should have done differently. Lots of things. Finally, the lights changed, and I sped on to Gerahu, my passengers waving frantically out the windows to head off any road rage my driving might have triggered. Thankfully, other drivers generally got out of our way. The hospital turned out to be a clinic with a lot of listless, sad-looking people standing out the front. Security waved us through the gate, but our guys had to go and get a gurney themselves. I waited with our patient, and one of the women held him and wailed. There was no response, no breathing, no heartbeat, nothing. A small crowd gathered. The guys couldn't figure out how to turn the gurney around when they got to the car, and in frustration, I grabbed it and I wrenched it. "Like this," I said angrily. The crowd backed away from me. I realised that people still considered me to be in charge, and none of them knew what to make of the agitated white man standing in a place where white people don't really go, especially at night. So I began barking instructions. "Yupala, grab his head," I said. "Yupala, his shoulders. That's it. Me, I got him legs. Okay, 1, 2, 3. We put him on the gurney and pushed him inside. No one paid us the slightest attention, except for people staring at me. There was no sign of any staff. A casually dressed man behind a counter told us emergency was the opposite way. It turned out to be a small door. People were afraid to open it. A nurse walked past, and I said to her, "This man's heart has stopped." She seemed ready to walk away. "He's not breathing. His heart has stopped," I repeated, stopping her. "He is dying." She gave me a mildly annoyed look, then opened the door. Inside, a man in a surgical mask looked over, then turned back to his work. My companions seemed ready to politely accept this. "Hey," I called out to the man I presumed to be a doctor, "this man's heart has stopped." We looked at each other, and then he came over and motioned for us to bring the gurney into the small room. Inside, there was a shrunken, shirtless old man sitting on a bed waiting and watching. On the other side of the room, a family crouched around a man in the recovery position on a similar gurney. The doctor had been working on him. The room was the size of a large bedroom. The woman I'd been talking to earlier grabbed me. "Come outside," she said, and I followed. Then, in a very calm voice, "It's okay. Just one of us will stay in there. That's our culture. But I think he's dead." I nodded because I didn't know what to say. "We have called his family, and they are coming now. You should go home." "What's his name?" I thought to ask. "Arthur," she said. "He's from Goroka in the Eastern Highlands. It's okay. You should go now." I suddenly remembered warnings about not getting involved in people's medical emergencies in PNG because of the risk of being blamed for their misfortunes. I didn't get that sense from these people. They were very grateful, but they were not Arthur's direct family. So I returned to my car, which people had clustered around. A security guard was standing by it, watching it for me. I was watched with intense curiosity as I got in and slowly drove away. I headed back to the better parts of town. One of my neighbours was still with me, so I dropped him home. Then, needing to talk to someone, I went to belatedly meet my friends who were eating at a nearby social club. I sat down with them and went through everything that had happened. We discussed how I could have got an ambulance for 60 kina, which is about $30, had I known the number, had I known how things worked, if things actually worked. I realised my first aid techniques had been out of date and hopelessly ineffectual. I'd never been to that club before, And not long after I sat down, a manager approached me and told me I was breaching the dress code because I wasn't wearing a collared shirt and trousers. He was polite and respectful, but said I would probably have to leave. Eventually, he went and talked to the club president, and I was allowed to stay with a warning. If you live here in PNG, it seems you can be too scared of the cost to call an ambulance. Or you might be unable to afford proper medical care, and your friend might die in the back of a stranger's car. An unfamiliar white man like me, who understands nothing about how things really are here. But you can rest assured that when you go to what is effectively the local RSL, everyone will be dressed neatly. Arthur did die that night. His family are trying to gather enough money to put his body on a plane back to the Highlands. They're also trying to find out, in the traditional way, who killed him. They believe someone must have worked sorcery on him for him to die so suddenly, and they suspect someone in his home village. I don't want to interfere, but I very much feel for the person who might be wrongly held accountable for his death. I tried telling his friends that I believe Arthur simply had a heart attack, something that can happen to people his age. But I don't think what I say has any bearing, just like what I did couldn't help him the night he died. This is Eric Twarczyk reporting from Port Moresby.
Until recently, the abuses and scandals that have plagued Australia's offshore detention regime have largely been blamed on the succession of federal governments, both Labor and Coalition. But rights campaigners are increasingly applying a blowtorch to the big end of the town, especially to businesses that make money operating and administrating detention centres. The largest of these is Transfield Services, a multinational corporation in charge of the centres on Nauru and Papua New Guinea's Manus Island. It made more than $1 billion out of the ventures. That's why a like-minded coalition of religious groups, unions, and lawyers are making a push for an investor boycott. They want to force down Transfield's market value and force it out of the detention center business. Ahead of the Transfield AGM, Annual General Meeting, this week, they've turned up the heat, releasing a document that categorizes what's alleged to have taken place. Peter Lloyd reports.
Hunger strikes and self-harm, rapes and riots, deaths and suicides. It's the shocking toll of misery in Australia's detention centres, famously described as factories for mental illness. Ultimately, the government of the day is responsible for the lives of the men, women and children detainees on Nauru and Manus Island. But it's the era of outsourcing, and Transfield Services has a $1 billion-plus contract to manage the catering, maintenance, recreation and educational activities. It subcontracts security services at both sites to Wilson Security. And campaigners reckon that means Transfield are complicit in violating 47 human rights laws. No Business in Abuse is a project involving the GetUp group. Some, like Shen Nariai Asami, who speaks for them both, are lawyers.
It's accepting children in those centres when you have doctors and nurses at the Royal Children's Hospital refusing to even discharge them out of the hospital because they know that they'll be facing abuse when they go back to those centres. So I think when you've got a company pocketing $1.4 million a day, to engage in practices that have been widely affirmed as being fundamentally abusive to men, women and children, I think they do need to take responsibility.
Do you want to run Transfield down?
I think we want the human rights abuses to stop.
In what way is Transfield staff directly responsible for the deaths, the rapes, the miseries that are involved in these case studies?
Well, I think, you know, the interesting thing is, and our laws acknowledge this as well, you can aid and abet, you can be complicit. You don't have to be the only person doing something for you to have some responsibility for an abuse. And that's exactly what's going on here.
So you're saying the Commonwealth DPP or state DPPs have failed in their duty to uphold the law?
We're saying that they're definitely not upholding international law, and I think you'll find that we've got quite a lot of support on that front, that the Australian government is breaching international law. I think what's interesting here is that we've pointed out that the company has obligations, and the company's adopted obligations. They've put out a policy that says they have a duty to respect human rights.
But isn't the wrongdoer you're talking about here the government's, not the corporation responsible for carrying out the programs of the government?
Well, I mean, If you're locking the doors, if you're assessing whether or not children can come in, if you're providing services that are putting people in a situation where they're running a fundamental risk of abuse and violence and harm, I think you take responsibility.
How many killers are there at Transfield?
I think there's a real distinction between saying someone's involved in gross human rights abuses and then calling them a killer.
How many rapists are there at Transfield?
Well, according to Transfield's own figures, and you've got to understand, obviously, that no one's been in these centres that we can verify figures for a while, so we have to go by the companies. Now, the company's own figures says that in the last few years since it's been providing services, there's been a critical or major incident of sexual assault every 3.5 months.
By which Transfield staff?
They don't say, as you can obviously imagine. They simply tell us what the incident reports are.
If you're so confident of your case, why don't you take them to the international courts?
Well, we're getting legal advice to see whether we can. The ability for someone to be prosecuted at the international courts is rather limited, but we will definitely try and make the case, and we do so in our report that there's a basis for doing that.
So in acknowledging that you don't have much likelihood of legal standing, you're going to go after them in the court of public opinion, essentially?
Well, I think the court of public opinion is the court in which we live in.
So you're saying people listening to this who've got shares in Transfield, they've effectively got blood on their hands too by supporting the company?
I think that what we're saying to people is, do you want to be invested in a company that is complicit in the systemic abuse of children, men, women, in a horrific way that has been pointed out by the international community now for years?
Transfield Services didn't respond to PM's request to come on the program. In previous statements, the company called the shaming campaign misleading and said it stands by its track record. That is about to be tested. It's in talks with the government for a 5-year deal to run the operations at Nauru and Manus Island. And if Transfield wants to lawyer up against the No Business in Abuse campaign, it too will face challenges. It would have to prove the campaigners' claims were false, driven by malice and cost it money. Tomorrow, both sides will come face to face at the Transfield Annual General Meeting in Sydney.
The Indonesian province of Aceh has toughened its already strict Islamic criminal code. Two new bylaws have been introduced in the Islamic criminal code that make homosexual sex punishable by public caning. Adulterers face the same punishment, and public displays of affection between people who aren't married will also be prosecuted. Caning in Aceh is an act of public humiliation that's designed to cause minimal pain. But the new laws have still outraged human rights groups. Indonesia correspondent Samantha Holly reports.
Muslim or not, new Islamic laws in Aceh apply equally, including to tourists. For human rights groups, it's a step too far that should have been stopped before it started. Andreas Hazono is from Human Rights Watch.
It is against international and national law in Indonesia. So we already warned the Indonesian government in Jakarta, beware. Review this law, cancel it before it is going too far.
Adultery, homosexuality and public displays of affection among the unmarried are all banned.
They are going to be serious. They have lashed so many people, especially women, for doing what they call adultery. And again, with public whipping.
And what do we know about the whipping? I mean, you say it's public outside a mosque on a Friday, prayer day. What sort of injuries are these women particularly suffering?
First, of course, they suffer from physical injury. But second, they also suffer from social punishment. Many of the victims of this public whipping, after the whipping, they decided to go away from their villages or their towns.
Aceh is the only province in Indonesia to adhere to Sharia law. It's at odds with the moderate Muslim practices across the rest of the country. Last month, two women were arrested on suspicion of being lesbians. Ismail Yusanto heads the radical Islamic political group Hizbut Tahrir in Indonesia. He says the punishment is mild.
Less than actual Islamic punishment, because in real Islamic law, in Sharia, whoever commit same-sex relationship, even same-sex marriage, or should be death penalty.
Death penalty?
Yes, death penalty.
And he says any discussion about human rights should be put in the context of Sharia law.
Anyone who want to talk about Aceh, should understand it, that very important to put once more human rights in the context of Sharia.
So you're saying that human rights, the definition of human rights under Sharia law or Islamic law is different than human rights
in an international forum? Yes.
Adi, a gay man living in Aceh, didn't want his real name used. He says more pressure needs to be placed on the Indonesian president to speak out against the laws.
I'm concerned about the passing of this law and particularly concerned with the response from national government because they seem not really concerned about this piece.
Andreas Hassano from Human Rights Watch again.
Unfortunately, the Jokowi administration does not do that. They let Aceh to go deeper into this bottomless well.
He says the Aceh bylaws violate the right to freedom of religion that's enshrined in Indonesia's constitution. It also breaches international law.
Before we end off, I just want to tell you about a couple of special transmissions that we actually have towards Europe and Southeast Asia that's outside of our normal schedule. From November the 14th, 21st, 28th, and December the 5th, 12th, 19th, and 26th, we're going to have special transmissions targeted to Europe between 9 and 10 hours UTC. These will also be audible in Southeast Asia. We don't have the frequency yet, but as soon as we do, it will be made available at our website and on next week's program. So on behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell wishing you well. Our email address, of course, as you know, is focus@pcjmedia.com. We'll see you again very soon. Have a great weekend. Bye-bye.